Good evening. I'd like you to turn to 2 Chronicles, the 29th chapter. 1 Chronicles, the 29th chapter. And I'll just read the last five verses there, starting verse 26. Thus David, the son of Jesse, reigned over all Israel, and the period that he reigned over Israel was 40 years. 7 years he reigned in Hebron, and 33 years he reigned in Jerusalem. So he died in a good old age, full of days and riches and honor, and Solomon his son reigned in his place. Now the acts of King David, first and last, indeed they are written in the book of Samuel the seer, in the book of Nathan the prophet, and in the book of Gad the seer, with all his reign and his might, and the events that happened to him, to Israel, and to all the kingdoms of the lands. I had not read those verses in quite some time as I was preparing for this, and I realized that with all of the information we do have about David, we've been going through the Civil War and stuff, and I can go to a bookshelves and I can find 10 or 12 books on Abraham Lincoln, each of them about this thick. I read one that was about this thick, about 600 pages. It was just about his cabinet. So think about all of the things that David did in 70 years of life and what probably was at one time written. And then what we have is just the high points, if you will, the main thrust of his entire life. And I think we know so much more about David than we do many of the other people in the Old Testament that we kind of feel like we know David better than a lot of them. We contemplate David's life, and we think about the decisions he made, and given the circumstances he was in, the temptations that he faced, and the trials, and the predicaments, many of them due to his own human failings. And so we relate to David on a level that perhaps we don't of many of the other characters in the Old Testament, at least. For all of his faults and failings, David was presented to us in the Bible as completely human, with all of the failings and all the stumblings that we fall into as well. But in spite of all that, in the book of Acts, the testimony is that he was a man after God's own heart. And that's because, unlike many or probably even most of his countrymen in his day and age, and for hundreds of years on either side of his lifetime, he never once worshipped any other god but Jehovah. And that's pretty significant. That's a pretty powerful testimony. If you just go a few books earlier into the book of Judges, you can read about Gideon and how brave he was. It's easy to look at some of these characters that we read about and think, well, you know, he needed a sign or something along those lines. But ultimately, he did an incredibly brave thing, because if you look at the world today, how serious people take their religions and the lengths they're willing to go to prove how serious they are, what Gideon did becomes even braver. So placing David in his time and context is wonderful, and there's a lot to be gained there, but David is presented like you and I would be when we're going to be judged on the final day. With everything we've done brought unto judgment, we're going to see all of our shortcomings. And hopefully, if we maintain our faith like David did, the Lord will still look at that and say, well, I have him written in my book of life. I'm going to save him anyway. And that seems to be ultimately how you can sum up David's life and legacy is he was ultimately, in spite of his failings, he was a man of faith. David's life, we're not going to, obviously can't cover everything within it, but starting mostly with when he attained to the kingship, he was about 30 years old when he became king, and he started off being anointed as a youth. And although we don't know exactly what age he was, they used youth a little bit differently than we do. He may have been a teenager somewhere in that time frame, and he was anointed by Samuel. But he received two more anointings. He was anointed by the elders of the tribe of Judah at Hebron, and then he would later be anointed by the elders of the rest of the tribes when they acknowledged him as their king. So as he progressed throughout his young adulthood, we see David go through stages where he was given more and more authority and more tasks, but also more and more difficulties to overcome. And persevering through all that, God blessed him by giving him successively greater and greater amounts of authority and responsibility until he had attained to the kingship of all the children of Israel. Saul had been given everything, and perhaps that is why God made it a little bit more difficult for David. That's just something that I hadn't thought of before, but it did pop into our mind. When Saul was anointed king, he was the king. And I don't know if that went to his head or exactly what went wrong with Saul there, but David was anointed, and then he started facing increasingly more difficult trials and circumstances. And through those, he persevered and he proved his faith. And I think that has a great deal to do with some of the questions I was asked to answer regarding David's relationship with God, but also his relationship to the people and how they would have viewed him. Now, early on, it's easy to understand why David became so popular. Who doesn't like military heroes? We read books about them, watch movies and film and TV shows about them, documentaries. Military stories and military heroes have been a part of human storytelling for as long as there have been heroes, or as long as there have been storytelling, perhaps. So David first gained national acclaim and fame as a young man after slaying the Philistine Goliath. And then, after having been given opportunity, he continued to lead successful campaigns against the enemies of Israel, primarily the Philistines, and the people were singing songs about him as far as his victories as a young man. And through this process, he showed his integrity, he showed his faithfulness. The story with Goliath is extremely important because it talks about, you know, there's several battles, there's several contests going on in that battle, and David was showing his faith. He was showing the power of his God over the power of the heathen gods, etc. And everybody was able to see it, and everybody was able to go tell stories. And it is interesting that Saul, one of the things that was supposed to make him a good king was that he was head and shoulders taller than his countrymen, at least on average, which meant that he was the one that should have taken on Goliath. That's what that means. So there was a failure on their current king's part, and they got to see David, a youth, come through because he believed that with God on his side, there was no way that he could fail. As David went through his wanderings, being harassed and chased by Saul, he gained a following. And we'll touch on some interesting things about that following at the end of the class if we have time. But he would go on after Saul's death to be anointed king of Judah, and 7 years later, the king of all the Israelites, having established his capital at Jerusalem. Jerusalem has an interesting history because we know that Caleb went and conquered at least the area of Jerusalem. But by the time, through the vicissitudes of fortune, it had fallen back into pagan hands. These people are called the Jebusites. And they told David that he would never be able to conquer it. And with David's cunning, he was able to do so. And Jerusalem provided him with a new capital. And it would have been considered perhaps neutral territory because it had recently been in the hands of heathens. It was centrally located, roughly so, anyway, regarding the rest of the tribes. And he immediately called it the City of David and purchased the threshing floor that would eventually become the site of the future temple. Perhaps the most important thing he did regarding Jerusalem was he brought the Ark of the Covenant there, which meant that that was a signal to everyone that Jerusalem was now going to be the religious focal point of the entire nation. So who was David and what was he like? Well, we know that he was the second king of Israel, and he's one of the most prominent and complex figures in the Bible. And we have his story primarily in the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, but also 1 Chronicles. And we get to see his journey from a young shepherd, which formed a great deal of his character and his virtue, and all the way to his deathbed, where he would pass on the kingdom to his son Solomon with some words of wisdom, but also a psalm of praise. So he was the youngest son of Jesse of Bethlehem, and he was overlooked even by his own family. You recall the story there, the eight sons of Jesse, when Samuel was looking at them one by one, looking for the one that God had chosen. But David was a shepherd by nature. That's kind of the way shepherding worked, is it was something you did all the time. And so looking out for others just becomes a part of who you are. And that's had a lot to do with David's character. Lots of shepherds were also musicians because it settled the sheep down and things like that. So you can just imagine David as a young man sitting there with his harp, composing songs and playing music. So his experience as a shepherd trained him in leadership, but also courage, because by the time he meets Saul, before the confrontation with Goliath, he tells him that he has already slain bears and lions. So there's a lot of courage that he had displayed along with his virtue. We already talked about the slaying of Goliath and how that would have made him a known figure among the children of Israel. The children of Israel's recent history had been one of difficulties. They had struggled with their faith and their religion, and just as we see throughout the time of the book of Judges, that was going to cause them trouble, just like God had promised them. And I don't know exactly what everybody's relationship with the religion was, but there seems to have been a lot of confusion given the stories we have in the first part of 1 Samuel, right on the cusp of Judges, that there were a lot of people who weren't sincere in their religion. And I think David was probably instrumental, at least for a short time, in instilling a sense of religious purpose in the people that had probably been lacking for some time, or at least was never consistent. So how does the Bible, as presented, or as David is presented to us, how does it describe David? Well, we've already talked about his courage and his faith and worship, and I think those two things play into this last part, which is David's willingness to repent. And I think that's part of the reason David is considered a man after God's own heart. When confronted with his sin, and David has some flaws. He could be obstinate, he could be ruthless and merciless. But when confronted with his own sin, David was repentant. We saw him after committing adultery with Bathsheba and the murder of her husband, David confronted by the prophet Nathan. And when it became obvious to him that he was the one who had sinned, he indeed repented. And there's another instance of that we'll take a look at. That's interesting. But David had moral failings. We just mentioned one. And that led to the dysfunction that was ever present within his family from that time on. The rebellion of his son Absalom, the instance with Amnon and Tamar, and just a total mess. And he brought that on himself with his actions. I'm going to skip a little bit here. But David was ruthless at times, but he could also be merciful. One I would point out here is the son of Jonathan, Mephibosheth, whom he had promised to take no vengeance on. And there is that curious passage where the men of Gilead were wanting vengeance on Saul's family. And he was supposed to send to them seven men of Saul's descent or clan or whatever. And he did that, but one of the ones he spared was Mephibosheth. It's one of those curious things that perhaps we don't know all the cultural goings-on there of how they executed their own sense of justice back then. But that is one of those curious cases where he made sure he wasn't going to break a promise. But I want to jump to Nabal and Abigail. because I like the story because it shows that it shows two different sides of David, one exceedingly dark, but one that he can still be reasoned with. So remember, Nabal's wife Abigail is described as both beautiful and wise or discerning. And after a servant warned her of David's impending arrival and Nabal's insulting behavior, she quickly formulated a plan that would prevent a massacre. And without telling her husband, she gathered a massive provision of food and rode out to meet David with his men. She went to David and humbly pleaded for his mercy, falling on her face before him and taking the blame for her husband's foolishness. She appealed to David's character and his conscience, reminding him of his calling, that it was from God, and his reputation, and the promises to him as a future king. She argued that acting in vengeance would be a heavy burden on his conscience and something he would later regret. And so David ends up being reminded of his trust in God's justice rather than taking matters into his own hands. It's an interesting story. I've heard it presented different ways. Some people have made the point that there was an expectation in that time period that if men were guarding your lands from thieves and invaders, that you were duty-bound to take care of them, and that was probably true, at least as long as there was an arrangement of some sort. Jephthah seemed to have made a living doing that himself. So that's not the issue here. The issue is who was messing with who. But David's anger is pretty harsh, and his plans are to massacre the family of Nabal in revenge for this. But David, once he was approached by Abigail in a good manner, a righteous manner, was deeply moved by her words and her wisdom, and his reaction demonstrates that even as angry as he could get, he still had the capacity to listen to reason. And he also had within him the capacity to be humbled. He immediately praised her, saying, "Blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from coming to bloodshed and from avenging myself with my own hand." So David is recognizing Abigail's agency here and the purpose she's played as an instrument of God to prevent him from committing a great sin. So what we see just in that one story is both sides of David. There's this light side, and there is kind of this dark side that he could be ruthless. And his initial kind of murderous reaction shows perhaps highlights a little bit of the brutality of the time that he lived in. But it also shows that he had already received enough of the Lord's ways, the Lord's instruction, his wisdom, that it could still penetrate any callousness that might have been built up there, and that he was also the type of leader that would listen to people who were under him. Ultimately, the decision to accept Abigail's counsel was his and his alone. Yet he ordered the attack. I have no doubt that his men would have carried it out. But he listened to her, and he was dissuaded from this destructive course of action. And then after Nabal dies of an issue following a drunken feast, Abigail is widowed and he ends up marrying Abigail. Okay. What relationship did David have with the people? Well, as we've seen early, he was very popular in his youth. Because of his valor, slaying the giant, and his many victories. He would have been known for his piety. And I don't doubt also that little interesting episode where he was Saul's harp player when Saul was distressed by a certain spirit that David could drive away with his harp playing. That probably was known and became part of David's legacy as well. But throughout a good part of his reign, the relationship with the people is kind of mixed because his son, Absalom, was able to gain a following after his rebellion. So David's popularity may not have always been the same. It may have vacillated up and down just like anybody else's. I'm sure there was some fallout from, I guess we could call it the Bathsheba and Uriah scandal, how to what extent that became known. It was probably known that he had a largely dysfunctional family that tends not to make people held in excessively high regard at all times. And then, of course, just mentioned Absalom's rebellion. So these things would have been known, and at worst, at least if I was alive at that time, I would have been the type to sit there and said, you know, David seems like a good guy, but something's going wrong here. Something's not always right in the state of Denmark. So David was probably, like anybody else, he had his supporters that could never see anything that was wrong, and he probably had some critics who could never see anything good. But the Bible presents him in a reasonable manner that lets us see him as he was, which is both having capacity for both good and evil. But a man that paid for his mistakes and fessed up to his mistakes. So I think ultimately he probably had something of a complex relationship with his people. But his legacy would be completely different, because his legacy would look back and see his failings, but the things that he left behind would have been something else. We know he had exceptionally loyal followers. From his time as a fugitive, David had gathered and collected a group of dedicated warriors that would become known as the Mighty Men or the Mighty Men of Valor. And this group remained fiercely loyal to him for his entire life, defending him against threats both internal and external. And the makeup of his followers is also kind of interesting. Uriah was a Hittite. He had two groups of warriors, one called the Pelethites and one called the Kerethites, and their names indicate that they were from the Aegean. So he was attracting an international following among his closest followers and his warriors. And I think that prefigures Christ in a way. He was going to be drawing from all of these peoples that he had come into contact with. And as David's kingdom extended, he would come into contact with more and more people from more and more backgrounds. But I think that also shows just what a magnet David was. I think these are people that probably volunteered their service, because when David's running around in the wilderness, he doesn't have a lot of money to pay people. They weren't using money back then, but you know what I mean. He wasn't in control of a lot of wealth. So these had to be men that were willing to follow him because of who he was. And I have no doubt also because of what they believed was promised to him in the future. But that says something about his character. He may not have been as famous as his son for his wisdom, but he could execute justice and equity. He seems to have been okay that we're told that David administered justice and equity to all of his people, which means he did it fairly. So his reign was remembered, as far as his legacy goes, as something of the beginning of a golden age of national unity and victory over his enemies. He had a lot of vassal states from the surrounding peoples, which set up Solomon for his great wealth. But the most important legacy regarding David was the what's called the Davidic covenant or the Messianic promise. So David, as a character, represents that enduring hope that there was going to be a Messiah come from his lineage. So, all right. Probably with the last half of our class, we'll change, talk a little bit more about religion and prophecy. But is there anything in the story of David that you would like to highlight for us?
Kyle, one of the things that always impressed me was the fact that David, even though he knew he was going to be king, was respectful of the kingship to the point of even endangering in his own life multiple times in order to show that respect. And I think what that shows is his devotion was to God and the principle that God set for him, as opposed to his own political power. Mm-hmm. He could have gotten rid of Saul easily, and his life would have been so much easier. But yet he was serving the Lord rather than serving himself, as opposed to Saul's example, of being afraid of the people, afraid of what they would say, and rather trying to solidify his power over the people without regard to what the Lord had asked him to do.
That's a great point. And it does seem to me that that David's mourning was sincere when he heard about Saul, and especially Jonathan. So,
one of the things that I noticed was that in his older years, for example, Saul had a demented spirit, almost like he was kind of going crazy, if you want to call it that. And David didn't show that at all in the way that he was in his older years.
That's true. Yeah, if you compare the two, David's, of course, he was inspired, but he's setting up the design of the temple and its worship, and I have no doubt writing quite a few psalms during that time period.
It's interesting how David did honor Saul, God's anointed one, but he used Bathsheba. I can't tell, rereading that chapter, that he had any remorse before Nathan arrived. Mm-hmm. Now, she was purified after the event. I'm not sure why, whether she recognized that she was now an adulteress or what it was that she's being purified for, but she was purified. And there doesn't seem to be any sign that David feels like he's done anything wrong. Maybe that's part of being king. I don't know. But when Nathan comes in, it's as if, you know, it's just a totally strange idea. Yeah. But David, when he became king, should have copied the whole law. And the punishment for an adulterer was what? Death. For both of them. Mm-hmm. They were both due death. That was the law. And David, as God's agent, was to enforce the law. That was his job as king. And all that seemed to be set aside. And so it's interesting how, when James describes the progression of sin, that there's somehow the mind, the judgment is shut off, right?
Yeah.
That's set aside for a while, and for a long while for David, because he had to conspire against Uriah and take care of that. Maybe he thought that was a clean way to get out of the whole deal. But it's just one sin on top of another sin on top of another sin. And then when Nathan comes, it's like, oh, yeah, that's right. I did do something wrong. It's just an interesting mindset, one that we have to be careful of.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the heart is deceptive above all things and desperately wicked. And David's was a human heart with all of our failings. Anything else? All right, well, if you go through primarily 1 Chronicles, it can get a little bit like Leviticus, reading about all the singers and the instruments and the plans for the temple and all that. But this is the culmination of all of David's efforts to bring everything to Jerusalem and centralize it. It was extremely important because the Jews were not going to be like other peoples at all, ever, or they weren't supposed to be. So if you went to these other nations, every city had its own temple or temples and shrines. No, you didn't really have to travel to be religious. You just went to some place locally, and that was for a matter of convenience. But God wanted his people, at least the men, three times a year to have to make an effort to go to a place that he had chosen and worship him. And so with the Ark of the Covenant moved to Jerusalem, that becomes the place. So then it's a matter of designing this temple and getting it built. And I've been looking through. We're never told that there was a vassal or tributary relationship between Tyre or Sidon and the Phoenicians and David or Solomon, but I don't see them getting paid for the work they do, which would perhaps indicate that they had volunteered this labor as tribute to David and Solomon. So to what extent David had conquered and Solomon would continue to rule over these various peoples, all of that was to show that God was favoring them and this dynasty in particular, and that the Davidic covenant was going to be something analogous or like what they were witnessing here, that Jesus was going to begin his kingdom in the city of David at Zion. From Zion the law shall go forth, which is repeated in Revelation. So that's one of the motifs here, that this was all going to have a foundation, and David essentially was that foundation, at least regarding this particular city and its relationship to the temple and therefore the people. The people were going to have a complex relationship with this temple. I don't know how much archaeology you read, but someone at some time after this built a identical temple not 15, 20 miles away from Jerusalem. It's been discovered. Probably there's a lot of politics and issues of control. There was another identical temple built on an island in the Nile called Elephantine, where there was a garrison of Jews stationed there for generations. They built their own temple, identical to the one in Jerusalem. So there's a lot of complexity to the Jews' relationships with other people's religions and even their own religion. But God was sanctioning this one. And I think that's the important thing to keep in mind here. God was sanctioning this man and this dynasty and the temple that his son would build for the Jews in perpetuity until that religion and its law were going to be fulfilled in Jesus Christ. So as you read through those chapters in there, I know it can get a little dry, but I think it's important to keep those things in mind, that this is how the Lord was working and would continue to work. He would choose vessels, men and women after his own heart, and he would give them his word and his orders, and it was the expectation that the people would follow. And that hasn't changed since that time. We follow Jesus. He's the head of our church and the head of this body. And so he's our David. He's the one that has been chosen, and we're going to follow. I think, is there any thoughts on that? There's so much I'm skipping over here. Let's go talk about some of the things in prophecy. Well, we'll do a couple, and look at a couple psalms, not in depth, but just in mentioning. There's a number of psalms that can be attributed to certain phases in David's life, at least by appearances anyway, or that at least were molded by experiences from the different ages. So probably the most famous psalm in the world is Psalm 23rd, where the Lord is called his shepherd. So when you read that, you can imagine David drawing on all of his experiences as a shepherd and facing the various difficulties that shepherds would face, and facing death in verses such as, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall lack nothing," or "I will fear no evil, for you are with me." So it revealed that there was a direct, not naive, but an almost childlike quality at that time in David's life of his level of trust in the Lord. And you see that exemplified in his stare down with Goliath. He just was unwavering, kind of the way a child would be, which reminds me of what Jesus said. Unless you become like one of these, referencing little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Psalm 8 talks about the majesty of God, and David is praising God's glory and marveling that God would concern himself with human specks of dust like us. And this psalm, again, shows a childlike wonder at the grandeur of God's creation, and yet God's marveling at God's attention to the smallest details and caring for people like us. Psalm 13 is one of the psalms that seems to have been written during his time as a fugitive from justice, or fugitive from Saul's vengeance. Psalm 56 as well. And then we had talked about Bathsheba and Uriah and the times he had sinned. There's Psalm 32, where he talks about the pain of holding sin with you, having not confessed your sin. And then, of course, the famous Psalm 51, a psalm of true repentance. But then there are a few that seem to have been written late in his life. Psalm 18 is a recounting of deliverance, and this psalm is repeated in 2 Samuel 22. It's a hymn of victory celebrating God's countless deliverances throughout David's life up to that point. So it's a retrospective summary of his entire life's path, highlighting God's role in his triumphs and in his survival. And then Psalm 25 talks about his dependence in his old age. So David was writing these psalms throughout his life, and they are interesting to look at in that perspective. And then we'll hop down and take just a couple minutes. If you were to characterize how this book, the 1 and 2 Samuel, tell David's story as compared to 1 Chronicles, what would you say the main differences are?
I'm not sure, but I've always thought that Chronicles gives more details than Samuel does.
It gives different details.
Yes.
Yeah. Jeff?
I was going to say 1 and 2 Samuel seems like it's happening, and writing about it, the good and the bad things happening to the kings, where later on when we're focusing on 1 and 2 Chronicles, it's really focusing on just the good things and highlighting the future coming of another king later on.
That's exactly it. So when it comes to David in particular, the Chronicles gloss over David's failings. And it is more focused on the temple and Jerusalem and the worship there. So the emphasis of 1 Chronicles and its portrayal of David is definitely much more messianic. And that's really the thrust of the Chronicles through Ezra and Nehemiah as well, is focusing in on the messianic story as far as that goes. David is a much more complex figure in 1 and 2 Samuel with all of his moral failings, but those are completely glossed over. So in 1 Chronicles, David is almost like Moses, where it's almost... You know, Moses was prefiguring Christ, and also David was. And David's stature is like Moses, as it's depicted in the Chronicles. So David received the temple's blueprint directly from God, according to 1 Chronicles, much like Moses did with the tabernacle. So there's this parallelism between those two figures. And David was divinely inspired by God for that foundation. And in 1 Chronicles, he's definitely modeled as the perfect, the ideal human king. And that would be true throughout the rest of really time. We still look at David much that way. But for the post-exilic community that was going to be coming back from Babylon, all of this just got pumped up bigger because the messianic expectations of the Jews just increased as time went on. And there's lots of reasons for that, but David looms larger and larger as time went forward. So he was portrayed as an obedient king primarily, and a standard for the Messiah. So we've only got a couple more minutes. There's a lot more we could have talked about, obviously. Is there any questions or comments or anything else that you'd like to add? Yes.
It's interesting to note that you have made a comment about, there's so much there, that he insisted on numbering the people. Do you have a thought, and he was even advised not to? I'm not trying to put you on the spot with a...
Yeah, I had that as...
That's just a wonderment of mine.
One of his things. What are your thoughts?
I don't have many thoughts.
That's a good way to ask a question.
I guess at this point, God has a thing about numbers. And now think of Gideon. You got too many. You got too many. Well, here's David maybe hitting a insecure moment because he's got the army leader going out for 9 months to number these people. And then God comes to him and says, no, 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 no. And here's some three choices of punishment. So yeah. Maybe he just fell back for my thing. He fell back into not relying on God as much as he had in the past.
Yeah, I think most people I've heard address that when they have is something along those lines, or he lacked humility for a moment, was perhaps, I don't know, yeah, the numbers that were at his command were made him prideful or something. But yeah, I hadn't given that too much thought. Anybody else have a thought on that? Yeah, I mean, there's so much I didn't touch on. He's mentioned in quite a few of the prophecies, and I guess perhaps the last thing I'll mention is something I had forgotten, but that was when Christ entered Jerusalem that last time, they were shouting, Hosanna to the Son of David. And I had forgotten that Hosanna meant something along the lines of pray, save us, or something, save us, please, or something along those lines. So, but it had also not only become a plea for salvation, but had become a triumphal shout as well. And it was kind of like when Jesus is coming in Jerusalem, they're saying, hey, here's the one that can save us. But I wonder how many of those people were thinking he was there to save them from the Romans, not from their sin. All right, thank you. Well, I'll be here next week, actually, doing Solomon. Have you ever tried to teach David in one session?